Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be hearing from James Burley, who is a retired plant scientist and who will be part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Diane Karp. She is Executive Director of the Santa Fe Art Institute, and I'd like to welcome, joining us by phone, Roberto Bedoya, who is the Executive Director of the Tucson Pima Arts Council. He's a writer and cultural advocate. And Robert Atkins, who is an art historian, curator, writer, and arts journalist. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And all three of them and more, who we'll talk about in a moment, will be involved in a panel discussion called Censorship at Tipton Hall this coming Friday, the 25th of February at 6 o'clock. That's on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. And Diane, why a discussion about censorship right now?
Well, very simply, in December, at an exhibition at the Smithsonian Portrait Gallery, it was a major exhibition called Hide and Seek. And it was an exhibition about images of homosexuality, portraiture of homosexuality in our country. There was a small piece that was on a touch screen in one of the galleries by an artist named David Wojnarowicz. And this work, which is a kind of flashpoint for the arts in terms of censorship, was on this small touch screen. And without ever having seen it, it was demanded by Representative Boehner that that work be withdrawn. And it was. And so it raised a flag once again. And interestingly, a flag that was raised by this very same work back in the late 80s and early 90s.
So this is not a new work.
This is not a new work. And the question was raised, why? Why now? Why focus on this? And for those of us in the arts, it's an old story. It's a story about the arts being the sort of canary in the coal mine. Wherein when times are tough, when there are difficult issues going on with government, whether it was in the 50s or it was in the 80s or in the 90s, the first thing to do is for the legislators and for certain people with very strong right-leaning ideas to point and say, oh, guys, don't worry about all this. Look over there. We need to censor that. It's obscene. It's irreverent. It's a challenge. And so here we found ourselves once again. And we at the Art Institute decided to take Wojnarowicz's film called A Fire in My Belly, which is his exploration of the realities of finding out that he was HIV positive and then had AIDS. And it was an outcry of sort of the horrors of living in a nation that was so condemnatory of a certain group of its own population. And the work is not obscene. The work is not explicit. The work is poetic and metaphorical, and it refers to great work through the 20th century and into the 21st century. And so we decided that as a way of addressing that, we would screen A Fire in My Belly. And so we started screening it. It ran all day, every day, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, at the Art Institute as a constant sort of repeating process. We also were screening...
Did anybody have a problem with it?
No. Everyone who came to see it couldn't quite understand what all the hue and cry was.
What was all the hue and cry about?
The guys are really going to address that, and we'll talk about it on Friday night. The point is, all the people who condemned it and demanded that it be withdrawn had actually never seen it.
Right.
Which is typical.
Well, and this is also such a replay that one man who runs a one-man operation called I think it's the Catholic Decency League or something, who raises money for his own salary, he was the one who brought it to the attention of the House of Representatives. And this is the same man who was doing this 20 years ago with artists like Andres Serrano and Robert Mapplethorpe. So it seems like the same old racket reinvigorated.
Exactly. And what we began to think about is that the arts have a very important role to play vis-a-vis censorship. They not only get body slammed and are a demonstration of how bad it is, but I think that they also rise to the occasion to engage and open the conversations for people to begin to think what it means and why it happens.
Roberto Bedoya, when did the issue of censorship first come to your attention? Tell us the specific story.
Well, all of us on this panel have stories because we've all been involved in sort of battles around guaranteeing the right of artistic expression. A number of years ago, I ran a network of alternative spaces called the National Association of Artists Organizations. And so this was a network of artist-centered cultural institutions and had a history and many of these organizations are still alive, presenting, you know, kind of the cutting-edge work of our time. So when the NEA many years ago denied the fellowships to four artists, Tim Miller, John Fleck, Holly Hughes, and Karen Finley, because the right wing was basically said that they were indecent, it ended up in a pretty long lawsuit called Finley versus NEA. The organization I was running, NAO, National Association of Artists Organizations, was part of that lawsuit. We were challenging the standards of decency language that was written into the authorization of the NEA, basically saying it was vague and having a chilling effect. So that was 9 years in the courts. We also were involved in creating, or NAO and myself was also involved in creating a kind of a very an organization called the National Campaign for Freedom of Expression, which was really out there looking at all the attacks on artists that were happening across the country in various municipalities. As those sort of 90s culture wars were being played out, the upshot of the lawsuit is that it went up to the Supreme Court and we lost. It had won in every lower court up to that moment. And basically it says that the Supreme Court said that, you know, we couldn't really prove that the law was having chilling effect because nobody had applied the law to deny funding or deny the rights of artists. But subsequently, you know, they were in error because it has had this chilling effect. And this current incident at the Smithsonian is an example of sort of like this chill that we are asked to live under of sort of like being leery of or of content, artistic content that asks us to think.
Now, we have an explicit First Amendment. When something like that happens, I mean, I know it's politics, but why can't the Smithsonian say, no, we have a First Amendment? Robert Atkins?
Good question.
Well, that they could, except they've kind of, the legal situation has been manipulated in such a way that for the same reason that the lid has been clamped on doctors talking about abortion, the idea that anything has federal money attached to it, which virtually everything in our culture does, means that the government can control this speech. So this is something that gets litigated ad infinitum. And, you know, one thing about the decency language and what the so-called decency clause was that this in itself was a new term really kind of invented by the right wing to be able to prosecute artists and others when previously obscenity had been clearly defined. And this whole area is really kind of a Pandora's box. For instance, writers have because of the novel Ulysses in 1929 and the court cases that brought it to the Supreme Court attention, writers have far broader parameters in terms of what they can present than visual artists. So the in every aspect of it, this is such a murky, ill-defined area, you know, that it's easily manipulated.
Robert Atkins, again, what do you think, and this is actually a question for all of you, what are the political conditions that tend to give rise to censorship? In other words, what do the times of relative artistic freedom look like, and what do times of censorship tend to look like politically?
Well, I think it's myopic to think that this is a new problem. Censorship has certainly existed since the beginning of our republic, but I would say one kind of early modern moment in the late 19th century. And this is about the same time that homosexuality was recognized as a identity rather than a behavior, with the era of William Comstock in the third quarter of the 19th century. And he was a man who kind of really invented modern American censorship, and he became the postmaster general so he could prosecute everything that traveled across state lines. And his interests were both in linking obscenity with birth control and control of women's bodies. So there were these Comstock laws that were initiated in 22 states and still hold sway in many of them. So this is this kind of recurring pattern. To think that this is a phenomenon that began in the 1980s is kind of silly. Interestingly, Comstock had his greatest success at a moment of economic recession, terrible recession, I think the 1880s, or maybe it was the 90s. And you know, once again, this seemed like a way for certain factions and elements in Washington to distract attention from real problems they weren't capable of solving.
One of the things that I think is pretty obvious is that there's this weird dichotomy, or at least to me weird, there's a ongoing censorship of sex but not of violence in the movies and on TV. And there's something, I don't, you know, everybody knows that, but there's something else that's not so much talked about, and I would love all of you to comment on this, because this, I'm just going to give you one example, but there are many like it. The other day, there was a videotape that was released, and it's on YouTube. You can see it, of I believe it was the Houston police brutally beating a burglary suspect who was on the ground and had already surrendered. It was a kind of Rodney King type of thing. And the news story, the news announcers were very explicit in warning that there's graphic violence and, you know, don't let your kids watch this and so on. And when you watch it, it's nothing compared to what you see on every cop show on television every single day. And what is going on when we feel like we can see infinite amounts of brutal fictional violence but are very protective about real violence, which is arguably more important for people to be aware of?
Well, I mean, one of the things that rises right to the top of mind is the reality that's going on right now in the redefining of rape. And we know that within the military and certainly within certain state legislatures, there is what seems to be an attack on women's bodies once again, and with it, an attack on issues of sexual identity, whether it's homosexuality, heterosexuality, transgender issues, bisexual issues. It's something that can be controlled, or they feel that they can control it, and they feel that everyone has strong feelings about it. And so the distractive quality that you can say, oh, quick, look over there, don't look at what's actually going on over here, seems to be a pattern that goes all the way back to the Comstock laws. And certainly when the Comstock laws were being enacted, we had bread riots, we had the socialist uprisings. There was a time that was enormously difficult, and the idea of sort of focusing on these aspects was a way of finding some universal fear space and pressing it as hard as they could to keep people from really dealing with the serious relative contemporary issues.
We might call that space the policing of behavior. And maybe it applies to people demonstrating in Madison, Wisconsin at the moment.
there's another issue that is not exactly about censorship, because the fact is we have in the United States a whole lot of uncensored, excellent journalism that's available. It's in plain sight for anybody who wants to read it, but it's marginalized because the funding structure for journalism is largely corporate. So you have a situation where you've got a lot of very good journalism that's uncensored, but it's also unknown to large majorities of people. And then a lot of junk information, which I think of as kind of junk food, that is ingested by a larger mass of people. And what I was wondering...
You mean Fox Network?
Well, not only. I mean, there's a lot of other really 10th-rate journalism. And I was wondering, what's the parallel, if there is one, in the art world?
Oh, that was an interesting question, because I was ready to take exception with your question in a certain way, that if we think of Europe as an exemplar of deeper thinking and more rational behavior, is the situation in terms of what the premier media is in any European capital so different? You know, Rupert Murdoch has his place, and I wonder if this really becomes the responsibility of consumers of media, you know? That we don't
I think it also demands more. Right. But I think part of it is that it's also a matter of education. We no longer train people to think critically. And one of the real roles of the art is to raise issues that people need to be thoughtful about. It's a place where the rules allow everyone equal access on an even playing field. And that's a space wherein you can open a civic discourse about very important issues. And that's the role that the arts need to begin to embrace more and more. I think one of the things that is also part of that media fear-mongering is that you create a situation where people fear that if they don't self-censor, that somehow the government's going to whack the NEA and take all the money away. And so in order to avoid making it worse, they tend to back away from issues. And that's exactly what went on with the film industry under McCarthy.
I think there's also sort of, to piggyback on what Diane just said about civil discourse, I think the hysterical media forces out there really are all about sort of establishing and working the terrain of sort of eliminist rhetoric. They just sort of work around sort of creating these others and demonizing them. And it could be you know, Mexican Americans in Arizona. It could be artists. It could be a union worker. There is this attempt to sort of other people in this profound way in order to consolidate a little power that privileges a certain sort of this mechanism that allows the powerful to have more power and really betray our democratic ideals. So the language, if you listen to sort of like how people talk and how this eliminist rhetoric is really sort of about like, oh, well, you know, that's, they're not patriots because they believe in the arts or some kind of weird logic.
I think also a civil discourse needs to be a rational discourse. And I just heard something on MSNBC about the wacky bills currently in state legislatures where the legislature in Montana is going to mandate that, pass a law stating that climate warming is a natural occurrence and it's a good thing for the economic climate of Montana. So energy has to be expended in dealing with these ridiculous assertions that should be beyond the limits of the conversation.
Now, I have another question for all of you, which is, there is a lot of really ugly, toxic stuff available, like child pornography and things that you probably wouldn't want to raise your children on. Is there any proper role for any kind of censorship? What should be the rules around that?
Well, you know, it's fascinating. One of the things that is so astounding to me is the contradiction between the role that the corporations play in terms of using sex to sell stuff, and that's all well and good. It's dangerous. Our children should not be raised on it. It is a system that denies the rights and the identities of a large part of our community. And yet, you put those same kind of seductive, sort of alluring images in the arts, and everybody freaks out. Because it's not the corporations that are controlling it, that are making money. It's the artist who is using the image to try and make people think about it. And it's another example of that gap that exists between the corporations that are supposed to be economic engines and the individuals who are supposed to be the citizenry of the nation.
But there's another category, which is people who are doing, who aren't artists getting NEA grants, just who are people doing really super ugly, exploitive schlock for money.
Whether it's movies or whether it's porno on the web, people are going to make money using the most awful of images. And I think that, you know, hate speech is a legitimate way of engaging. Those sorts of images are like hate speech. And they should be dealt with in the same way.
Meaning First Amendment rights.
First Amendment rights, they are not productive. They are not constructive. They are not about sharing information. They're evil. And I say that, you know, advisedly. But to compare pornography, which has no redeeming aspects and isn't about helping people to think about identity, it's exploitative. And to compare that with, you know, Mapplethorpe images is absurd.
Well, and Mary, also you use the word schlock, and I think there's always been bad quality art. I mean, that doesn't seem to relate to this discussion of art in any case. But if you're talking about pornography, I mean, that too seems outside the realm of art, you know, a kind of a use of photography that has nothing to do with art photographers.
Right.
Part.
Any other comments before we go? We've just got a minute or two left.
Besides telling everyone to come on Friday night to Tipton Hall.
Besides that.
Not only hear Roberto and Robert, each of them taking a slightly different perspective and address, but also Harmony Hammond, who is a local artist who has been in the battlefield for a long time. Lucy Lepard, who will be talking about an exhibition she did on Amendment 2 called Too Much, which Amendment 2 being the homophobic amendment, and Zane Fisher, who is one of the smartest, most thoughtful and thought-provoking young people we have here in Santa Fe, who's going to be moderating.
Well, on that note, it actually now is time to go. Robert Atkins is an art historian, curator, and arts journalist. Roberto Bedoya is executive director of the Tucson Pima Arts Council, as well as being a writer and cultural advocate. And Diane Karp is executive director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks again for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program James Burley. He's a retired plant scientist from California State University at Chico. And tomorrow, Thursday, February 24th, from 6 to 7:30, he will be talking on the subject of food security for emerging countries at the O'Keefe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue here in Santa Fe. And it's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So what, first of all, do we mean by food security?
The ability of individuals, and therefore of countries, to have sustainable production so that all members of a family are able to feed themselves adequately with volume as well as proper nutrition.
And so emerging countries, what are they emerging from? What do we mean by that term?
Let me back up for just a moment. The French, bless their hearts, had an interesting phrase that they would use to refer to developing countries, les pays en voie de développement. The countries that are in the process of developing, now they refer to them as les pays émergents, emerging countries, emerging from the doldrums of poverty. And that seems to be a more acceptable phrase in today's parlance than developing countries was some years ago.
And third world countries before that, and so on.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay, so they're emerging. When I think of that term, I just think emerging from the slime.
No.
The primordial ooze.
Emerging in their capacity to satisfy the needs of individuals.
And so when we have countries that have basically a larger population than they can support food-wise, what happens and what is the role of developed countries, or whatever they're, emerged countries, whatever they're called, in helping them out?
Well, surely population growth has been and will continue to be an issue that has to be faced. But it is a very sensitive issue in certain parts of the world, and one that I won't try to deal with. And so the second part of your question has, what do you do? You know, what does a country do when it has individuals who are not capable of producing enough? Well, you produce more. And how do you produce more? Well, that requires certain infrastructure. Does the country have an infrastructure? Does it have individuals, institutions that are capable of addressing the issues, the production issues that a country faces? And so a lot of America's efforts in the past, you know, have been directed to building institutions. That's no longer the case, Mary Charlotte. But 20-some years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, even 50 years ago, that was the primary emphasis of America's efforts in taking technology to India, to Pakistan, to various countries in North Africa, Central Africa, and East Africa. Now,
what types of institutions?
Agricultural universities or institutes of agriculture. You know, for example, I worked at the Institut Agronomique et Veterinaire in Rabat, Morocco for 7 years. This was an institute that trained individuals up to the equivalent of American master's degree in various disciplines in all areas of agriculture as well as in engineering. And it was the notion that by helping that institution grow, therefore by helping individuals, the faculty members, increase their capabilities in research and development, the country itself could help itself. And if you take a look at Morocco today, in contrast to when I went there initially in 1978, you do see a marked improvement in wealth in the countryside as well as in cities. And so that the building of that institute, IAV, Institut Agronomique et Veterinaire, did, the project was able to do what it said it was going to do.
And yet that's no longer the policy?
It's no longer the practice of USAID. USAID, that was probably they had given a contract to the University of Minnesota. And the University of Minnesota operated that contract from 1970, 1971 until 1991. The projects that USAID currently funds are in more soundbite forms and may have to do with very specific accomplishments, rather than building an institution. When you say you're building an institution, that means you're talking about people. You're not building a dam, which you can see, and you know when you start and you know when you finish. When you're building an institution, you're building a capacity for that institution to deal with the food issues that a country faces. And those are only going to be faced by individuals who have the capacity, the intellectual capacity, as well as the financial means to research those needs and to find ways of meeting them.
So it sounds like the former way of doing things had to do with building self-sufficiency.
Yes.
Both food self-sufficiency and the intellectual and institutional self-sufficiency to deal with whatever food or other problems came up.
That is accurate. Today, I only know what I read about USAID. I mean, it's been years since I was a contractor with them, and I can't speak too loudly about the nature of the work that they do. But there's more billions of dollars being spent now than there was 2 decades ago. But the money that is spent has to do, yes, with increasing the sustainability of production, increasing the sustainability of institutions, but it has ceased to build institutions with long-term commitments to an institution so that it goes through its birthing pangs as well as its teenage years and matures. That is not the general practice any longer of the United States' approach to development.
And so how would you characterize it? What are we as a nation now trying to do to help food insecure nations?
This may sound like I'm trying to avoid your question, but spreading democracy is a primary objective, and within that general umbrella of democracy, if countries are friends of the United States, they will find that projects that may be put forward by individuals within the country for increasing production in one form or another will in fact be funded. But the United States, if I say its efforts are not always altruistic, that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone.
Well, when I hear the word spreading democracy, my detectors go up very, very quickly. BS detectors.
Well, certainly,
to be clear.
At one time, when USAID was first created in 1961, it was an independent agency. It was not associated with the State Department. That was changed some years ago, but I can't tell you exactly when. So now the Secretary of State is the person in charge of USAID, even though there is a director for USAID. But it was not under the aegis of the State Department initially, whereas now it is. And what does the State Department want to do? Well, people will have various opinions on that.
Right.
But certainly they want to spread democracy. You know, and they want to spread the American way of doing things around the globe, and they make efforts to do that. Now, the institutions, the countries, rather, that receive the largesse of America's foreign development funds are what countries? I mean, that's historically it's been Egypt, it's been Pakistan, it's been Israel. You know, for different reasons, but those are the three elephants in the park, you know, that have received the lion's share of America's foreign development aid. There are many other countries, you know, through Peace Corps, through contracts that have been given to various companies to work on specific projects in countries, you know, where America's money goes, your tax dollar and mine goes.
Now, there is always this question when it comes to U.S. foreign policy about whether it is in the U.S. interest for other nations to be truly self-sufficient versus being just economically self-sufficient enough to buy our products.
Yes. How do I respond to that? At one time, and it may still be a program within the United States, it had a program called PL 480. Public Law 480 was passed decades ago. And what it was is that the excess of American wheat corn production was so many metric millions of metric tons were given to countries who could then sell that on the open market and fund some of their own projects. I don't know for sure, but I believe PL 480 still operates. But right now, and there has been since about 2008, real concern that those products, which in fact had been almost in excess, like the principal cereals that people consume, rice, wheat, and corn, much of which comes from the United States, that those foreign markets were essential, you know, to the American economy. Well, if you look at the price now on the Chicago Commodity Stock Exchange, you know, you'll see that those products are very high priced, and countries cannot afford to purchase them. And the American farmer is laughing all the way to the bank, you know, because of the prices that she receives.
You are a plant scientist. Maybe we should talk a little bit about actually the kind of work
that you
do.
I would feel far more comfortable, Mary Charlotte, in that realm than what you've asked me so far.
Well, what has been the nature of your work as a plant scientist working abroad? You've worked in Egypt. You've worked in the Philippines and other places.
Yes, true. And in all of those, the countries from Morocco to Rwanda to Sri Lanka to the Philippines to Egypt to Nepal to Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. I don't know if I have them all or not.
That's a lot.
In April, it will be Mali. All has been directed towards improving the capacity of growers to produce. I haven't dealt with markets, which is an important consideration. I haven't dealt with economics, which is an important consideration. Except the information that I sent you about grafted tomato production in the Philippines, of course, economics was a principal part of that work. And it only has achieved some success because the economics work in favor of being able to produce tomato when tomatoes are not normally produced in central Luzon because of flooding and hurricanes that come through. So economics is very important, but my personal work has dealt with production.
And so let's talk about tomatoes for a moment. When you go to a place to help them increase their tomato production, what kind of basic problems, just on a botany tomato growing level, do you see?
Well, let's start with the Philippines, and then I'll go to Egypt, if I may, please. I spent several years in the Philippines, but only a matter of weeks in Egypt, over 3 years, but a much shorter period of time. The Philippines is a very diverse country, agriculturally, ethnically, socially. And it suffers, as much of Southeast Asia does, you know, from periodic hurricanes, which can flood large areas and make agriculture impossible, you know, for a period of time. If tomato is flooded, in 3 days it's dead, and you have to start all over again. By grafting the tomato onto eggplant roots, we were able to show, you know, that in fact farmers could have their crop flooded for 3 days, 4 days, and the plant would survive, which meant that they could produce tomatoes during what is referred to there as the off-season, that is from late May, June until December. That is the period of time in central Luzon in the Philippines that is subject to sometimes severe hurricanes. And when tomatoes, an important source of vitamin C, an important source of vitamin A, are not grown. And farmers know that they can't grow it during that time. If they could, then the price of the tomato some years ago when I was there was about 20 pesos a kilo. 50 pesos equaled $1. So you're, whereas during the hot, dry season, the Philippines doesn't have a cool season. It's either hot, dry, or it's hot and wet. So during the hot, dry season, when folks are growing tomatoes by the bushel full, why, they sell for 2 pesos a kilo. So if the farmer had the capacity of growing tomatoes during this period of time when tomatoes are not commonly grown, then he would have added income, and the folks who live in such large cities as Manila, you know, with 12 million plus people, you know, would have an additional source of vitamin and nutrition. And so we introduced that technology to a number of growers in Central Luzon, and thanks to some folks who are still there, you know, Filipino scientists are pushing that practice. And it is, if I say it, it's growing in, I can't really say that because I don't know for sure, because I've long since lost track of the spread of that technology among additional growers. But it did work, and farmers made money. If you remember from reading that article, that some farmers did, some farmers did not. But those who did not, we knew why they did not. And they did not make money because they didn't do what we had suggested they should do.
Right.
And so if they follow the rubrics of the technology, they would make money.
Now, you have in some of your work discussed reasons why the very best plans that you lay out for other people don't work. There are things as simple as language barriers.
Surely, and some of those language barriers I'm probably not aware of. In the Philippines, for example, most folks will speak English, and so communication is not a difficult matter. In Egypt, the other country where I've worked with tomatoes, why, I have to have a translator. Now, is that translator sufficiently well-versed in agriculture, the agricultural sciences, so that he or she, can translate the concepts that I'm talking about accurately? And the short answer is, I don't know for sure. But I always give a translator several pages of terms and their definitions weeks in advance, so that individual will have a chance to go through those terms that I would commonly use, not with growers, unless they were American growers, but so that that individual will be able to translate the concepts into, in this case, Arabic. Now, yes, I know a little bit of Arabic, but it's so little as to be almost worthless.
What was the nature of your work with tomato farmers in Egypt?
To identify specific plant diseases that may be impediments to yield, and let them and teach farmers how and technicians how to identify those diseases and what they should do in order to combat and slow down rates of development of diseases. Tomato farmers in Egypt have a notion that they are plagued with a number of different diseases in what is referred to as Upper Egypt, which is south, almost to Sudan. Whereas my observations suggest that they don't have the problem they think they have. And so what do they look at? You know, they look at their leaves, they look at their stems, they don't look at their roots, and they see a spot, and they think, therefore I need to put on some pesticide, sulfur, or a copper compound. And my observations have been such that I think that's totally a waste of their money and a waste of time, and they don't need to do it. I'm not opposed to them putting on pesticides of one sort or another if it is warranted. But if it is not warranted, then they're wasting their time and their money. And so the nature of what I was doing was developing a key, you know, like you go through a dichotomous key. Are the lesions on the leaves or on the stems or on the fruit? Okay, I make that decision. Then if they're on, are they circular, are they angular, etc.? And so one could, by following different steps in descending order, you can come to the proper identification. With some, I should hasten to say that with some diseases don't lend themselves to that approach to identification. You need a biochemical approach. But then there are tests that technicians can learn to use, and we are trying to show technicians with a virus disease, for example, you know, how can you determine which virus is causing the problem? And if there is a virus, or whether it's just the imagination of the grower himself or herself.
Now, this sounds like a perfect example of where if there were an institution like a school of agriculture in that region, people wouldn't have to rely on a non-Arabic speaking big guy from the U.S. coming over and telling them how to do their jobs.
Yes. But then you're getting into another side of it that is the more human side. There are institutions. There are institutions in Upper Egypt, in Aswan. Yeah, in Aswan, there is a university. And there are people there who are well trained. Then the next question is, well, why aren't they doing this work out? And they do not have the financial resources to move. I mean, Egypt's a huge country. And if you go down to Aswan, and if you head east, excuse me, if you head west, you go through one of the biggest kitty litter boxes in the world, and it's all sand, and then you find where there is irrigation, they're able to grow crops of one sort or another. And they will grow tomatoes because the production of tomatoes is being pushed in the country currently. But those scientists do not have the means to move readily and often.
And the people from the United
and
States
the, and the folks that I do some volunteer work with, I'm a volunteer, so I'm cheap. But the organization that sends me, there's been two. One is called Winrock International from Little Rock, Arkansas, and the other is ACDI VOCA, V-O-C-A. I've asked what that acronym means, and nobody's ever told me. I'm assuming it's a legitimate organization. But they get their money from USAID for what is called a farmer-to-farmer program. And it takes old, retired folks like me and says, okay, you have a certain expertise in an area, in this case, plant diseases. We think that you can be of a help here. And so they will send me to Nepal, to Egypt, to Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, blah, blah, go on, the other stands. And there you attempt to help people solve problems and to make their production more sustainable.
James Burley is a retired plant scientist from California State University at Chico. And once again, tomorrow, Thursday, February 24th, from 6 to 7:30, he will lead a student discussion on food security for emerging countries. It's at the Georgia O'Keeffe Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. It's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science Cafe for Young Thinkers series. As always, admission is free, and light refreshments will be served. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.